Pseudopod, episode 151, July 17th, 2009. This week's story, The Undoing by Sarah Totten. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and whilst you can call me Al if you wish, I will, under no circumstances whatsoever, call you Betty. So stop asking. Our story this week comes from Sarah Totten, an author whose work has appeared in Fantasy, the best of the year 2007, Realms of Fantasy, and Black Static. This story first saw print in the anthology Tesseract's Ten, edited by Ido van Belkom and Robert Charles Wilson, and published by Edge Science Fiction and Fantasy in 2006. Your narrator this week is the only woman Nina Kimberly the Merciless fears, her creator, the magnificent Christiana Ellis. So pull on your gloves and scrub in, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Undoing by Sarah Totten. There are two accepted procedures for performing ocular excision. One involves suturing the eyelids shut prior to dissection and removal of the skin and soft tissues around and within the orbit. In the second method, the eyelids are sutured open before the eye is dissected out. Given my patient's particular circumstances, I was instructed to use the first method. This method has an added appeal for me. Although the second method is less bloody, it involves performing the operation with the eye open, and I dislike being watched while I work. I tugged the leading edge of the suture line, pulling it taut enough to bury the knot, and then I cut the end of the suture flush with the skin. I assessed my work. I had achieved a nearly perfect apposition of the tissue's edges. A scar was inevitable, but this one would be subtle, once it healed, as near to invisible as my skills could render it. An ugly procedure done neatly. Apart from professional pride, the presence or absence of a scar was moot. Without eyelids, I had removed them, to keep it in, a prosthetic eye could never be fitted. The final effect would be anesthetic. But that was, after all, the point. With artful lighting, the photographers would make it appear even more grotesque. I had seen their work with other high-profile criminals on the covers of magazines and in the newspapers. No doubt they would do my work justice. I swabbed the blood along the incision line. The sound of the patient's breathing broke my concentration, and I remembered that I was not alone. I turned off the anesthetic and pulled the surgical drape from the prisoner's face. My incision crossed the prisoner's temple, stopping just shy of the hollow of his empty orbit. It was swollen and still orange with prep solution. With a sense of quiet satisfaction, I stripped off my surgical gloves and gown and disposed of them down the chute. The patient's blood had soaked through the gown and stained my scrubs beneath. Afterward, I debriefed Dr. McCall about the surgery. I use her title as a courtesy here. She is an administrator, a doctor on paper, but not in practice. This is apparent in the length of her fingernails and the clean femininity of her clothing. I wore my blood-stained scrubs into her office to make her aware of who was doing the cutting. "Good job, Dr. Lewis," said McCall to me, as though she would know. All she had ever seen of this patient was his file, and perhaps the press release photos. I cleaned up in the compound's concrete-floored shower before going to the secure room where the prisoner was recovering. I sat by the end of the bed, typing the surgical report on my laptop. The record said, "Harrow, James, age 26, but he looked much older than that. He bore the hallmarks of prolonged stress. Deep lines scored his face from the corners of his eyes halfway down his hollowed cheeks, and his tousled hair was shot with gray. No doubt, Harrow thought his actions had been justified. The world had been unkind to him, and he was simply fighting back. I myself thought that the world would be a better place. The air would be cleaner without him in it." I was watching him when he woke. His remaining eye was blue, the same pale color as hospital-issue scrubs. It was striking in the dim light, silvery. He blinked, winked several times, then turned and reached over the bed rail with a splayed hand, the shackles around his wrists jingling. The chain, fastened to the rail at the head of the bed, pulled taut. He could reach no further. "What is it?" I asked. At the sound of my voice, he went still.
"My glasses," he said.
I took his glasses from the bedside table just beyond his groping fingers and put them into his hands, careful not to let him touch me. I wondered which of those hands had held the gun. Harrow unfolded the glasses and put them on, then almost immediately took them off. I unfocused. He polished the lenses with the edge of the bedsheet. Then he put the glasses back on. The white cotton pad glared at me through his left lens. He took the glasses off and touched the cotton padding above his cheek, kneading it with his fingers. He began to pick at the tape, attempting to peel it off. "Leave the dressing alone," I told him. He stopped working at the tape and pushed himself back to sit up against the head of the bed. He squinted in my direction, clutching the dressing, his face screwed up as though I had put an onion in his skull where his eye used to be. "Take your hand off the dressing," I said. He did so reluctantly. His breathing became harsh as I checked the dressing's integrity. I could detect no visible seepage.
"What happened to my eye?" he said.
"It's gone," I told him, straightening. He massaged the cotton under his palm. I'd dealt with enough victims in the past to know that he didn't yet realize what had been done to him. It takes people time to adjust to the loss of something they can never have back. It was, in a small way, a loss of innocence that I was witnessing in this man. Harrow released the dressing. Casually, he pulled the chain around his right wrist taut, as though he were testing its strength. He allowed the chain to slacken, regarding its length in silence for a few moments. Then he lunged at me. By reflex, I recoiled, but his hand was brought up short with a sharp click of the chain. The curtain by the bed stirred, and the guard put his head around it.
"Can I talk to you outside, doctor?"
The guard had no doubt been watching us through the video surveillance monitor behind the curtain. In any case, I had no desire to remain in such close proximity to Harrow. Before we left the room, the guard looked at Harrow.
"Watch yourself," he said.
He looked inclined to use his weapon on Harrow there and then. In the hallway outside, the guard put a comradely hand on my shoulder and spoke to me quietly.
"I have to caution you not to go near this prisoner unless it's medically necessary, doctor. He tried to assault a civilian last week during his public parade."
It was good to be reminded that Harrow deserved those shackles, that he deserved everything I had done to him, and would do to him. I left Harrow in the recovery room and returned to the prison compound's makeshift operating room. From the instrument table, I picked up the stainless steel scraps bowl, mounded with bloody gauze. I rummaged in the soft contents of the bowl until I found the globe of the eye I had just excised. Almost surprised to see it there, I picked it up. The eyelids were sewn closed with their matted lashes looking like an insect's legs crossed in death. What had this eye seen before the gun had gone off? When it had narrowed at its victims in the federal office building, had it seen them as people or as mere targets? The eye of James Harrow, terrorist, murderer. I dropped it into the biological waste bag for incineration. It made an insignificant wet sound as it landed. I chased it with the congealing contents of the metal bowl. 2 months later, I amputated Harrow's hand at the wrist. As Harrow was left-handed, I had been instructed to take off that hand. I had decided that it was too risky to leave Hera unattended under general anesthetic during surgery, so I had asked that someone on the prison hospital staff be brought in to monitor him. Though he'd be unable to cope on his own should anything go seriously wrong, at least he was there to notify me of any drastic change in Hera's vital signs. As long as he didn't watch me, I was fine with it. It left me free to concentrate on the surgery. I found the procedure challenging. I hadn't amputated a hand in several years. That hand had been severely macerated in a bomb blast. Harrow's hand was sound and healthy. In this sense, the procedure was more straightforward since Harrow's tissue was viable, not damaged or diseased. What made it difficult was something more subtle. From a surgeon's standpoint, it is more difficult to take off a hand at the wrist than it is to amputate an entire arm with the shoulder blade attached. The arm is held to the body by muscles and tendons only, whereas the hand is attached to the wrist with ligaments. Cutting ligaments will readily blunt a blade. By the time I'd finished the procedure, I had gone through 3 disposable scalpels. I released the tourniquet on the patient's arm and began tying off the weeping blood vessels before closing the skin over the stump. I cut the end of the suture and set the scissors down on the instrument tray. It was only then that I noticed, in a moment of dull surprise, the motions of Harrow's chest as he breathed. It is an odd facet of performing surgery that, while the bleeding vessels I clamp and ligate remind me that I am working with living tissue, I nearly always forget until the surgery is complete that the tissue is part of someone alive, that the world is bigger than the window in the surgical drape. It's something that happens to you when you become a surgeon, though I don't remember exactly when it happened to me. You learn to separate the world within the operating room from the one outside. Most people can cut the meat on their plates without being bothered. It is a series of small but uncomfortable steps from there to cutting human cadavers, to opening a living, breathing patient, and putting your hand inside, manipulating it, altering it. It lends a certain feeling of power, of entitlement, to grapple with that force inside a living thing. It is a feeling we surgeons need in order to do what we have to do. The handcuff no longer fit around Harrow's left wrist, and it dangled empty next to his cuffed right hand. I turned on the lights and stared at the too white expanse of his face. With the bandage gone, I had not removed it, a lonely black eyebrow arched over the cavity below. In the 2 months since his eye surgery, the scar had healed as well as I had predicted. Harrow regarded me with his single silver-blue eye. Slowly, he lifted his bandaged stump before his face. Tendons rippled and tightened in his forearm as he tried to flex his missing fingers. He took a few heaving breaths, then raised his head to look at me. He said nothing, but a light gleamed in his silvery eye. For a chilling moment, I felt something pass between us, something momentous, something I didn't understand. Then he closed his eye, and he was just a criminal again, my patient. I swallowed and went back to the operating room. There seemed to be a lot more blood than the last time. Splashes of it, shining like black currant jelly in broad sweeps around the mouth of the floor drain. I hosed down and disinfected the floor, took the instruments out of the tray where they'd been soaking, and began to scrub them clean. Had I been employed in a hospital, this would not have been my responsibility. But this room was my domain, and everything in it was under my control. That was how I liked it. I knew that what I was doing here was unpopular with some. Even those who approved did not like to contemplate my doing it. I took no joy from it myself, beyond simple pride in serving my country, and the satisfaction in knowing that, with every stroke of my scalpel, with every suture I placed, the world became a better place. Deterrence was the key. The terrorists would see my work, The public would see it when Harrow was turned out to the media, and they would know what this country did to people like Harrow. The more I worked, the fewer of his kind there would be. The fewer crimes we would see, the safer the world became. I cleaned every flake of blood from the instruments of my profession and laid them out neatly in a row to dry. It gave me a sense of completion, a sense of rightness. At 2 a.m., I was paged back to Harrow's room. I realized why as soon as the elevator doors opened and I heard Harrow screaming. One of the guards met me as I stepped out.
"Can you shut this bastard up?"
"I'll give him some painkillers," I said. As I walked past, the guard put a hand on my arm.
"Not too much, though, Doc,"
he said. The noise was worse when I entered the room.
"Finally," said the guard.
Harrow belted out another lung-cleansing scream.
"Oh, cry me a river," said the guard. "Or make that half a river."
Harrow twisted around in the bed and shot him a helpless glare.
"Oh, what's the matter, cop killer?" said the guard, raising his hands. "You all cut up over what I said?"
I drew up the hydromorphone and injected it through the port in Harrow's IV line. Harrow surged up as the needle went in, his scream ending in a sigh. Almost immediately, he relaxed in relief.
"About time,"
the guard said, and he sat down by the bed. I pulled the curtain across between me and the guard.
"Thanks," said Harrow.
"Don't thank me," I said. "I'm just following orders." After a moment, he said, barely audible, "So's I." He spoke with the calmness and clarity a strong analgesic brings. "Don't try to justify what you did," I said. He was silent for several moments. At last, he spoke.
"What gives you the right to do this to me?"
"What gives you the right to kill someone?"
"I love my country," he said.
"So do I."
"You believe in a country that does this to people?"
He brandished his stump in my face.
"Do you?"
"I believe in peace. I believe that people have the right to be safe from people like you."
"But not from people like you,"
said Harrow. "It's simple justice," I said. But I knew that on some level that was not what he had meant, that I hadn't fully grasped what he had meant. The curtain rings jangled, and the guard's heavy boots clacked on the tile. There was a look of barely restrained rage on his face.
"Hey, Harrow,"
he said.
"Guess what the doctor's taking off next?"
He smirked and clutched his crotch. Harrow's eye went from the guard to me.
"Yeah,"
said the guard.
"If you're lucky, maybe the doc'll leave you a stump to jerk off with."
For the first time, I saw an expression of genuine fear in Harrow's face. "A word," I said to the guard. I stepped out into the hallway. Before he could speak, I said, "Listen to me. I make the decisions in this patient's treatment. I decide what he needs to know. I don't need you telling him the protocol. Understood?"
"I'll treat that piece of shit cop killer however I want,"
said the guard.
"And I don't have to take insults from a civilian."
He went back into Harrow's room. I was not like the guards. It did no good to take pleasure in Harrow's suffering. Justice was objective. It had to be. Cold. Precise. To be otherwise was to be like Harrow. My way was humane. Clean, painless, the way it ought to be. Castration was a procedure I had never performed before. I had my assistant leave the surgical text open on the table so that I could consult it during the procedure. The text referred to the procedure delicately as orchiectomy. The recommended technique was to draw the testes out through an inguinal incision, a cut along the fold where the abdomen meets the thigh. The recommendation was based on the prevention of spread of a tumor. Since this was the primary reason for performing castration, Harrow did not have cancer. I decided that the simplest and best approach was to make an incision down the midline of his scrotum. 3 times during the surgery, the patient moved, and I instructed my assistant to turn up the anesthetic. Though the surgery was otherwise uneventful, it had been some years since I had performed a procedure with which I was unfamiliar. I observed the patient in recovery with a certain degree of professional concern. Harrow lay on his side, eye squeezed closed. With his unshackled stump, he was stroking the sheet beside him over and over, as though he were patting a dog. A comfort-seeking gesture. With the stethoscope, I listened to his heart. I could hear him breathing loudly, masking its rhythm. "Mr. Harrow," I said. I straightened, and as I did, he opened his eye and looked at me. I felt something pass between us again, something elusive but powerful. I saw the light in his eye, the same light that had once shone out of the eye I had held in my hand. The light of whatever it was that lived in Harrow, beneath his body, beneath the hate, beneath the propaganda, beneath whatever it was he said he believed and why. A human light. The look on Harrow's face stayed with me for the rest of the evening and afterward. It would not go away. I went online to find out what I could about him, information released to or discovered by the public. It might have been lies, but I was looking for something unofficial, something human, perhaps some inkling of understanding. He was indeed just 26 years old, born and raised in the city 20 kilometers from the compound. My city. My neighborhood. He had lived an unremarkable life. One brother, William, a law-abiding citizen. Parents still living, likewise law-abiding, divorced recently. An unexceptional academic record. The high school he had attended was not far from my own home. I may very well have seen him from my car some day in the distant past. 1 year in university, studying fine arts before dropping out, 6 years before his arrest. He could have been anyone's son. He could have been mine. What had happened to him? A week later, during his next public appearance, James Harrow attempted to escape. He was shot several times by his armed escort before he got more than 20 feet. Fortunately, the shooting occurred before he was brought into the public gallery, and no bystanders were hit. I was paged within minutes of the incident. I had seen everything on the newscast, and I drove to the prison compound with a troubled mind. Since his sentencing, I was the only doctor attending him. The first thing I did when I arrived at the compound was to pump enough hydro into him to make a healthy man vomit. His eye was open, and he appeared conscious, but he simply stared off into the distance. I found 5 contusions on his back, pulsing red. I'd seen a mark like these on a police officer I'd treated once. "Was he wearing a Kevlar vest?" I asked.
"It's standard procedure," said the guard. "The spectators in the gallery are checked for weapons, but it's an extra precaution. For his own protection."
I had no doubt that if he hadn't been wearing it, he would have died in the gallery. But he hadn't escaped unscathed. His legs were still shackled, and one of the bullets had pulverized most of his calf. The damage was so extensive, I considered amputation. "That was a stupid thing to do," I told Harrow. "Did you actually think you could get away?" Though his eye remained open, he did not respond at all, not to my voice nor to my touch while I examined him. The light in his eye, the one I had seen last time, was gone, and that made it somehow harder to meet his gaze. When I induced him for surgery and it finally closed, it was a relief. By the time I left him after 4 hours of surgery, he was stable but still unconscious. I stayed on in one of the visitors' rooms, reluctant to leave the compound in case I was needed. As I sank down onto the hard chair in my quarters, I realized how tired I was. Tension contracted my shoulders. Why had he done it? He had been out in the public gallery before. He must have known the level of security there. Without help, he would have stood no chance of escape. Had he been expecting one of his associates to be in the gallery? At midnight, I was paged again to Harrow's room. His heart had stopped. I was unable to bring him back. He had escaped after all. By the time I returned home, the sun had set. I sat in the car for some time, staring at nothing. Then I started the engine again and drove. A few minutes later, I pulled over to the curb. Across the road from me was the school James Harrow had attended. I took in the 15-foot-high fence, the barbed wire coiling over the top. The schoolyard was nothing but concrete, completely safe. Nowhere to hide, nowhere to plant a bomb. The street was ultra-bright, not a single tree. It was a good neighborhood, a safe neighborhood. I could not remember the last time a crime had been committed here. I saw the sterile blue lights of a police car down the block and realized that if I lingered here, I would likely be questioned. I drove off, remembering my own childhood days. Grass, trees. It hadn't all been concrete and wide open space then. There had been places to hide. Mystery. There had been danger, too, but also beauty. It seemed to me that I remembered a light about this place, akin to the one I had seen in Harrow's eye. A living light. The thing we surgeons grapple with but can never touch directly. I drove and drove, looking around me for that light. But it had gone, and I could not remember remarking on its passing.
Way back in the very third episode of The West Wing, there's a series of pivotal discussions about what exactly a proportional response is. If a man is killed, do you destroy an airbase? What is a life, fundamentally, worth? It's an impossible call to make, and one that not only demands you step across a moral line, but frequently has you do so before you're even aware you are moving. An eye for an eye is the oldest example, one regularly cited, both by the sort of Christians who tend to borrow out the words love and forgiveness in their Bibles, and by the people who point at that sort of Christian and cite them as indicative of the entire faith. And it's meaningless too, because if you've been maimed, and you maim someone else, the only thing that's going to happen is two people will bleed. Does a murder deserve another murder? To me, no. To others, absolutely. And that, of course, raises the question, who's right? The answer to which is yes, because this is, again, one of those questions that can never be solved, never be brought into land. But does anything justify cruelty? Is malice ever acceptable? That one's easy. No, never, under any circumstances at all. I view myself as something of a bully gourmet, having sampled the dubious delights of primary, secondary, and workplace mockery, and malice is the worst thing you can ever have deployed against you, certainly as a man. Of course a beating hurts, of course it's terrifying, but being mocked, being humiliated, that stays with you. That means the bully wins every time they see you, and you cringe just a little, even though you try not to. That's malice. That's cruelty. That corrupts everything it touches. Or, to put it another way, torturing someone doesn't just maim the victim, it maims the torturer too, because after a while, you get a taste for it. Pseudopod is powered by flowers and cookies and happy songs, all of which are remarkably combustible when fed into the mighty furnaces of Pseudopod Towers. The furnaces? Well, they're powered by you. Not in a bad way. If you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it, and I promise we, speaking for escape artists, our authors, and the people we rent hosting space from, will all be very, very grateful indeed. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Our closing music is by Hopeful Machines, a side project of Ego Likeness. You can find out more at egolikeness.com. Please join us next week for Hometown Horrible by Matthew Bay. In the meantime, Pseudopod has been mistrusted since day one.